I am very happy to be here tonight and very honored to have been named a Chancellor's Fellow. Over the last year, I have been preoccupied, as many others have, with one thing, and that is Iraq. Of course, a number of my colleagues and friends in the anti-globalization movement, we've also done work on such issues as the WTO and the Free Trade of the Americas over the last year. But currently, my main activity at this point is in the anti-war movement, in which we've been trying to build up a fairly strong global opposition that's more or less organized to the current foreign policy. Iraq, as Bob Woodward puts it in his book, A Plan of Attack, has, and I quote, sucked all the oxygen out of the system. It is the central event of our time, our Spanish Civil War, our Vietnam, and everything else seems to be put on hold, both here and in other parts of the world, until there is a just and decisive resolution to the terrible situation created by the U.S. invasion and occupation of that country. When George Bush landed on the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln off the California coast on May 1st last year, to mark the end of the war in Iraq, Washington seemed to be at the zenith of its power, with many commentators calling it, with a mixture of awe and disgust, the new Rome. The carrier landing, as Canadian scholar Anthony Hall points out, was a celebration of power, a spectacle that was masterfully choreographed along the lines of the American sci-fi thriller Independence Day and Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will. And let me just quote from Hall. In the opening scene of Triumph, Adolf Hitler is pictured approaching from the air the Nazi Party rally at Nuremberg in 1934. President Bush began his big spectacle on board the Abraham Lincoln by touching down on the vessel's deck in an S-3B Viking jet. Emblazoned in the windshield of the aircraft were the words, Commander-in-Chief. The U.S. president then emerged in full fighter garb, invoking the imagery of the dramatic concluding scenes in Independence Day. In those scenes, an American president leads a global coalition from the cockpit of a small jet fighter. The aim of this U.S.-led operation is to defend the planet from the attack of outer space aliens. But fortune is fickle, particularly in wartime. Today, Bush and his advisors must be wishing they had not staged the May 1st photo spectacle. Two events coming close together have spelled disaster for the American enterprise: the resistance in the city of Fallujah and the scandal that has erupted over the sexual abuse of prisoners at the main military prison of Abu Ghraib in Baghdad. Abu Ghraib illustrates in such a compelling fashion the moral bankruptcy of Bush's war. And on this, I have nothing to add. All I would like to say is that Abu Ghraib and the way it is handled will be a turning point for the U.S. Army in Iraq. The apparent game plan of the Bush people is to limit those charged, disciplined, and punished in connection with the Abu Ghraib abuses to a few enlisted men and women, and maybe a handful of officers. The abuse will be attributed to a few bad eggs and will not be regarded as systemic. Most likely, guilt will be prevented from reaching up the chain of command and to the civilian leadership that planned the whole criminal invasion that spawned the conditions that led to the abuses in the first place. When some high-level officers have to be sacrificed, as is apparently the case with Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the highest-ranking soldier in Iraq, the strategy seems to be to cashier them, then quickly remove them from public view instead of prosecuting them. The only problem with this strategy is that it may save the high military and civilian command, but would be devastating to morale at the lower levels. My sense is that we will very soon see the return of the conditions of demoralization that nearly destroyed the U.S. Army in Vietnam. In Vietnam, some enlisted men took to fragging or killing their officers with grenades, when they no longer saw any sense in being told to risk their lives in a war that had lost its legitimacy and its meaning, or when they were simply angry at their superiors. There were over 200 recorded fragging incidents in Vietnam. So far, in the Iraq War, there has been only one reported as of the middle of 2004 by a soldier who rolled 3 grenades towards his officers in Camp Pennsylvania, Kuwait, on March 23, 2003. There may be more that have not been reported. Now, a strategy of having enlisted men and women take the blame for Abu Ghraib would be an invitation for fragging and other acts of rebellion by demoralized soldiers who are encountering more and more deadly resistance to what many of them now see as a senseless war. What I would like to spend some more time on is the significance of Fallujah. In early April 2004, Fallujah became the turning point of the war in Iraq. Located 1 hour west of Baghdad on Highway 1, Fallujah is a resort town of 300,000 on the banks of the Euphrates River. Contrary to U.S. military propaganda, Fallujah was never considered a Ba'ath Party stronghold during the days of Saddam Hussein. What turned Fallujah into a center of resistance to the Americans was the indiscriminate firing by U.S. troops on a largely peaceful demonstration against their presence on April 29, 2003, during the American advance on Baghdad. That massacre turned the town decisively against the U.S., and over the next year, under a steady drumbeat of attacks, U.S. troops withdrew from the town under the guise of handing over security functions to Iraqi police and civil defense forces, according to an account in the Financial Times. In late 2004, 4 U.S. civilian mercenaries connected with a Blackwater security company, rather highly paid people, who had been recruited from the special forces within the U.S. military, I guess along the lines of privatizing the war in Iraq, were attacked by Iraqi resistance fighters and their bodies were mutilated, as many of you saw. In what will certainly go down as one of the worst decisions of the U.S. occupation authorities, a posse of 2,000 troops from the U.S. 1st Infantry Expeditionary Force encircled Fallujah on April 4 to search out and punish the Iraqis involved in the incident. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, Deputy Director of Operations for the U.S. military in Iraq, promised, and I quote, an overwhelming response, unquote, saying, and I quote, we will pacify that city, unquote. A defiant slogan repeated by the residents of the city during the months of occupation was that, quote, Fallujah is the graveyard of the Americans, unquote. April is the cruelest month. And the month of April saw that chant become a reality, with a significant number of the 1,102 U.S. combat deaths accounted for by the fighting in and around the city. But there was a bigger sense in which the slogan was true. Fallujah had become the graveyard of U.S. policy in Iraq. The battle for the city was not yet over on April 9, when the U.S. forces declared a unilateral suspension of offensive operations. But the Iraqi resistance had already won it psychologically. Irregular fighters, fueled mainly by spirit and courage, were able to fight the elite of America's colonial legions, the Marines, to a standstill on the outer neighborhoods of Fallujah. Moreover, so frustrated was the U.S. command that in its trademark fashion of technology-intensive warfare, it unleashed firepower indiscriminately, leading to the deaths of some 600 people, mainly women and children, according to eyewitness accounts. Captured graphically by Arab television, these developments created both inspiration and deep anger that are likely to be translated into support for the resistance. Repelled by the carnage were not just the Iraqis, but U.S. allies as well. Seeing the effects of massive firepower on civilians, General Sir Michael Jackson, the chief of the British General Staff, distanced himself from the United States, and I quote, we must be able to fight with the Americans. That does not mean we must be able to fight as the Americans, he asserted, unquote. That the British approach to post-conflict doctrine is different to the U.S. is a fact of life, end quote. The U.S. forces were confronted with an unenviable dilemma. They could stick to the ceasefire, which Iraqis would interpret as meaning they couldn't handle Fallujah, or they could go in and take the city at a terrible cost both to the civilian population and to themselves. There was no doubt that the heavily armed Marines could pacify Fallujah, but the costs were likely to make that victory a Pyrrhic one. That is, technically a victory, but strategically a defeat. The Marines took the less disastrous option, entering into what some saw as an unusual agreement, creating a new force known as the Fallujah Protective Army to enter the city and provide security. It would consist of up to 1,000 former Iraqi soldiers led by a former division commander under Saddam. How the new unit would function was unclear, but members of the Fallujah resistance were soon seen patrolling the city streets. No doubt, some of them were people who had participated in the ambush of the Blackwell mercenaries. Whatever are the concrete arrangements on the ground, the important thing is to note that Fallujah has been seen and widely interpreted not only in Iraq, but throughout the Arab world as a defeat for the United States, and its likely impact is to swell the ranks of an already burgeoning resistance with thousands of new recruits. The truth is, the neoconservative scenario of quick invasion, pacification of the population with chocolates and cash, installation of a puppet democracy dominated by Washington's proteges, then withdrawal to distant military bastions out of the reach of the insurgents, while an American-trained army and police force took over security in the cities, was dead on arrival. For all the country's many fractures, the cross-ethnic appeal of nationalism and Islam is strong in Iraq. This was brought home to me by two incidents when I visited Iraq, along with a parliamentary delegation shortly before the American invasion. When we asked a class at Baghdad University in the spring of last year what they thought of the coming invasion, a young woman answered firmly that had George Bush studied his history, he would have known that the Americans would face the same fate as the countless armies that had invaded and pillaged Mesopotamia for the last 4,000 years. Leaving Baghdad, we were convinced that the young men and women we talked to were not the kind that would submit easily to foreign occupation. 2 days later, at the Syrian border, hours before the American bombing, we encountered a group of mujahideen heading in the opposite direction, full of energy and enthusiasm to take on the United States. They were from Libya, from Tunisia, Algeria, Palestine, and Syria, and they were the cutting edge of the droves of Islamic volunteers that would stream into Iraq over the next few months to participate in what they welcomed as the decisive battle with the Americans. As the invasion began, many of us predicted that the American invasion would face an urban resistance that would be difficult to pacify in Baghdad and elsewhere in the country. Famously, Scott Ritter, the former UN arms inspector, said that the United States would be forced to exit Iraq, quote, with its tail between its legs, defeated. It is a war that we cannot win, unquote. We were wrong, of course, since there was little popular resistance when the Americans entered Baghdad. But we were eventually proved right. Our mistake lay in underestimating the time it would take to transform the population from an unorganized, submissive mass under Saddam to a force empowered by nationalism and Islam. President Bush and the U.S. proconsul in Iraq, Paul Bremer, have constantly talked about their dream of a, quote, new Iraq, unquote. Ironically, the new post-Saddam Iraq is being forged in a common struggle against a hated occupation. The Bush people thought they could coerce and buy the Iraqis into submission. They failed to reckon with one thing, spirit. Of course, spirit was not enough, and what developed in the year after the invasion was a movement traveling on a steep learning curve from uncoordinated acts of resistance to a sophisticated repertoire combining the use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, hit and run tactics, stand your ground firefights, and ground missile attacks. The U.S. command, of course, and the coalition authority dismissed this as rearguard actions by al-Saddam remnants when the rest of Baghdad knew that this had grassroots support and that this resistance was growing. Unfortunately, these tactics have also included strategically planned car bombings and kidnappings that have harmed civilians, along with U.S. and coalition combatants and mercenaries. Unfortunately, too, in the Islamic resistance effort to sap the will of the enemy by carrying the battle to the latter's territory, it has included missions that deliberately target civilians, like the Madrid subway bombing that killed hundreds of innocent people. Such acts are unjustifiable and deeply deplorable. But to those quick to condemn, one must point out that the indiscriminate killing of some 10,000 Iraqi civilians by U.S. troops in the first year of the occupation and the targeting of civilians in the siege of Fallujah were on the same moral plane as these methods of the Iraqi and Islamic resistance. Indeed, the American way of war has always involved the killing and punishing of the civilian population. The bombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, all had the strategic objective of winning wars via the deliberate targeting of civilians. So please, spare us the moralizing about the so-called civilized conduct of war by the West and the so-called barbarism of the Iraqi resistance. Despite the fact that the situation has spun out of control, the Bush administration hangs on, pushing through a so-called transfer of sovereignty to people associated with the U.S.-controlled interim governing council that enjoys very little popular legitimacy. To whom will sovereignty be handed over? What exactly sovereignty will sovereignty consist of? Where will the legitimacy of the government come from? What exactly is the relationship of the coming government to the United Nations? The United States reserves the right to control its military forces in Iraq and to maintain them there indefinitely. A qualification from Secretary of State Powell that the U.S. would leave if the incoming government asked it to is disingenuous, since that regime would never ask for the elimination of the military might on which its own existence depends. These are the unresolved issues that lend substance to the New York Times charge, and I quote, that the only unifying theme for Washington's policies seems to be, quote, desperation. The United Nations Security Council's recent endorsement of the post-June 30 arrangements will not make this U.S.-imposed solution any more acceptable to the Iraqi people or to the world. My own sense about it is just like the October U.N. Security Council resolution that authorized the multinational coalition force that in about 2 weeks, people will have forgotten about yesterday's U.N. resolution, because what will matter is what goes on the ground, and that is not going to affect the situation on the ground. But neither does the New York Times and the liberal opposition to Bush have any answers. The Times itself, while attacking Bush for inept management of the occupation, endorsed giving the United Nations, quote, real authority over transition political arrangements, end quote, bringing in more foreign contingents to participate in providing security, and increasing the number of U.S. troops in Iraq in the short run, end quote. In other words, in terms of increasing troops, I'm reminded of the Cambodia solution. Try to end the war by sending the troops to Cambodia. But all the elements that have been mentioned by the Times are already in the Bush plan, including drawing additional troops from the U.S. forces in South Korea. Insofar as the Democrats can be said to have an approach, it approximates the Times' quibbling with John Kerry, the Democrats' presidential candidate, making the key issue not substantive differences with the Bush plan, but the management of the process. He would manage the Iraq intervention better than Bush. In what was touted as the defining of speech of his policy on national security on May 27, 2004, Kerry said NATO should be asked to provide troops, the training of Iraq's security forces should be internationalized, and an international high commissioner be appointed to organize elections, draft a constitution, and coordinate reconstruction. All this is well within the Bush agenda, as was Kerry's call to increase the U.S. military by 40,000 troops. Noting that Bush had already issued orders to increase the military overall by 30,000 by January 2005, a spokesman of the Bush campaign noted, and I quote, "John Kerry is playing following the leader," unquote. None of the Democratic candidates during the primary, except perhaps Dennis Kucinich, dared to say, to utter the five words that constitutes the only viable strategy, and I quote, "immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops," end quote. A key consideration before Fallujah and Abu Ghraib was that this stance would harm them in the November elections. Despite the fact that even before the uprising in Fallujah and the Abu Ghraib scandal, according to the Pew Research Center, 44% of Americans said that troops should be brought home as soon as possible, up from 32% in September 2003. But by late May this year, there was no longer any excuse for timidity. 52% of those surveyed by the Gallup poll said the war in Iraq was not worth it, and only 45% said it was, compared to 29% and 68% a year earlier. Yet, this is not a tactical issue for the Democratic leadership. According to the Liberal Financial Times columnist Gerard Baker, and I quote, "Whether or not you believe Iraq was a real threat under Saddam Hussein, you cannot deny that a U.S. defeat there will make it one now," unquote. This is, of course, a non sequitur, but illustrates the fact that both liberals and conservatives are still operating within the American paradigm of empire. While liberals and Democrats may have come to the conclusion that the invasion was not justified, they dare not call for a unilateral withdrawal, since this will be, in their view, an incalculable blow to American prestige and leadership. In other words, they fear that the demonstration effect of an America leaving Iraq with its tail between its legs, to use Scott Ritter's image, would be disastrous for the credibility of U.S. power in the future. No easy exit seems possible from Iraq at this point, as moral failure of the highest degree engulfs the ruling regime in Washington and the loyal opposition. What seems to be in the making is the continuation of an occupation with no viable political rationale and military rationale, and bereft of any moral legitimacy. The paralysis that has gripped the Democrats on Iraq can only be broken by one thing: a strong anti-war movement such as that which took to the streets daily and in the thousands before and after the Tet Offensive in Vietnam in 1968. So far, that has not materialized, though disillusionment with U.S. policy in Iraq has spread to a majority of the U.S. public, especially after Fallujah and Abu Ghraib. Indeed, at the very time that it is most needed by the people of Iraq, the international peace movement has had trouble getting into gear. The demonstrations on March 20, 2004, the anniversary of the occupation, were significantly smaller than the February 15, 2003 demonstrations, when tens of millions marched throughout the world against the projected invasion of Iraq. The kind of international mass pressure that makes an impact on policymakers, the daily staging of demonstration after demonstration in the hundreds of thousands in city after city, is simply not in evidence, at least not yet. Perhaps a major part of the reason is that a significant part of the international peace movement, particularly in the United States, hesitates to legitimize the Iraqi resistance. Who are they? Can we really support them? These questions have increasingly been flung at me and other advocates of an unconditional military and political withdrawal from Iraq. The use of suicide as a political weapon continues to bother many U.S. activists who were repelled by statements such as that of the Palestinian leaders who proudly asserted that suicide bombers were the oppressed people's equivalent of the F-16. The role of Islamic fundamentalists and the possibility that on account of the presence of a majority Shiite population, a post-US Iraq could turn into Islamic State a la Iran has also been a matter of great concern. Yet, there has never been any pretty movement for national liberation or independence. Many Western progressives were also repelled by some of the methods of the Mau Mau movement in Kenya, the FLN in Algeria, and the National Liberation Front in Vietnam. What Western progressives forget is that national liberation movements are not asking them mainly for ideological or political support. What they really want from the outside is international pressure for the withdrawal of an illegitimate occupying power so that internal forces can have the space to forge a truly national government based on their own unique processes. Until they give up this dream of having an ideal liberation movement tailored to their values and discourse, many US peace activists will, like the Democrats, they often like to criticize, continue to be trapped within a paradigm of imposing terms for other people. Let me conclude by saying that things can only get worse for the US in Iraq. Moreover, the Iraqi resistance has transformed the global equation. The US is, in fact, in a weaker position today, globally, than it was before May 1st, 2003. The Atlantic Alliance that won the Cold War no longer functions. The situation in Afghanistan is more unstable now than last year, and US troops are also pinned down there. Islamic revivalism, against which the US has ranged itself, is now more vigorously spreading. In Latin America, we now have governments in Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, and Bolivia that are avowedly against the old neoliberal economic policies imposed by Washington. The World Trade Organization is in serious trouble after the collapse of its ministerial in Cancun last September, and Washington's vision of the free trade of the Americas failed to materialize owing to Latin American opposition during the FTAA ministerial in Miami last November. Owing to the hubris of the Bush administration, the U.S. is suffering from that fatal disease of empires, imperial overstretch. And its threat to institute regime change in other countries, such as Syria, Iran, and North Korea, is no longer credible. Let me end by saying I think that the crisis of the empire is not only good for the world. It is good for the people of the United States as well. For it opens up the possibility of Americans relating to other peoples as equals and not as masters, really learning from them and really respecting and appreciating them. Failure of the empire is, moreover, a precondition for the emergence of a truly democratic republic that the United States was intended to be before it was hijacked to be an imperial democracy. I thank you.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.